You're listening to An Argument for God from Beauty by Sam Welbaum. Sam is a staff apologist at apologetics.com in the United States.
All right, let's go ahead and start. Sorry, there's no there's no other chairs. You're good right there?
Oh, yeah.
Then I won't try to find you a chair. Enjoy. Enjoy the ground. It's happy to have you, as are we. Okay, so you're in apologetics, and let's see, I forget what the title, An Argument for God from Beauty, I think. I had a hard time figuring out what to name this, because I just wanted to be like, you know, can't we just say, like, you know, God and beauty and stuff? And he's like, no, that's not catchy. I'm like, yeah, could be, but wouldn't have been. But so what we're going to talk about today is the idea of beauty as it relates to apologetics or theology. It's where I do my main area of study. My name's Sam Welbaum. I'm with apologetics.com, which, as I've explained to many people at the booth, is not exactly Apologetics Canada, but, like, we're adjacent. And so, because everyone comes up going, oh, this is Apologetics Canada. I'm like, ah, yeah, but in California. So, different. So I'm from California, which is why if I have a weird accent, sorry, that happens. The thing is, I do that. Like, I talk in, like, other, like, dialect things. It's like 1 in 15 times down in California when I'm naturally talking, I will say sorry or against, and everyone's like, oh, you're doing a thing. And I'm like, no, I'm a poser. I just really wanted to not be American, I guess. So, but when I do it up here, everyone's like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, not here. I just want to be one of you. Anyways, but I'm working on a PhD in philosophy of religion and theology because I love student debt. And I really want to be a very, very educated Starbucks barista. So, because when you get your PhD in philosophy, religion, and theology, that's what, and you don't want to be a pastor, that's your option. It's like, oh, you're either going to be a successful professor or just something else. And I'm probably going to be option B, but here's hoping for A. But my specific area of study is in what's called aesthetics, which is what we're going to be talking about today. Before we do that, though, we should probably talk to God. And so let's open up in prayer, and then we will talk about aesthetics, God, beauty, and things like that. Let's pray. Father God, thank you for this day. Thank you for this weekend, just this conference, where we are able to come and learn how to better defend your truth and glorify you and honor you in defending your accuracy, your truth, the Christian worldview in the face of a culture that doubts and denies you, God. I just pray that all of us are able to increase in our knowledge and wisdom and better image you in all ways after this weekend, Father. Just be with this time here. Give us wisdom as we think through these interesting and fascinating, inspiring, and also difficult topics, and just let us leave here with a mind more attuned to you, Father. Praise God in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, so aesthetics, which, if you've heard the phrase, it's probably been the word, it's probably been primarily used to like makeup artists and stuff like that is how aesthetics gets used a lot today. That's not what we're talking about. And so if you came in for that, I'm sorry. You'll be disappointed. This isn't makeovers in Jesus. And why are so many of you getting up? I'm joking. That was just for you on the tape. They didn't stand up and leave. That's just a joke for you that they didn't get because they didn't know what was happening. Aesthetic, it comes from a Greek word, though, that's talking about sensation. So when we talk about aesthetics, the philosophic discipline of aesthetics, it's understanding sensation. So what, like, my PhD dissertation is going to be on boredom, because I think boredom is actually a fascinating topic, and why is it so prevalent in our society? Why are we so scared of boredom? And I think it's because the transcendence has been removed. However, I'm not talking about boredom here. I'm talking about beauty. So maybe that'll be next year. But that falls under the area of aesthetics. Humor falls under the area of aesthetics. Why do we laugh at certain things? Why do we think some things are funny? Why do we think some things aren't? What does it reveal about us to think that some things are funny and whatnot? And so beauty falls under it as well. When people may not have thought about aesthetics too much, and the thing that might seem esoteric, when I'm teaching my intro to philosophy class, I ask my students to think about a few things. And so we won't spend time kicking them around here, but I want you to kind of just start thinking about how aesthetics can kind of apply into just your everyday life, how it already does, and eventually how it's going to lead to us talking about with God stuff. But, like, okay, so imagine that you are inside a cubicle, and if you sit inside a cubicle every day, this will be easier for you to imagine. If not, just imagine you're in a cage of depression. But so I clearly did not enjoy my cubicle job. But like, so imagine that you are in a cubicle and you're sitting there, and all you're doing is you're sitting in your cubicle for 20 minutes. You sit in your cubicle looking at your cubicle wall for 20 minutes. Now compare that in your mind to sitting on a bench overlooking an ocean with the sun setting behind it for 20 minutes. For some reason, the second 20 minutes is much shorter and much more enjoyable than the first. But you're doing the exact same motion. Like, you're still just, like, in this motion. That's me sitting. Like, you're still just doing this. Like, nothing has changed. Your butt is on something, and you're looking straight ahead. Nothing's changed, but what you're observing, what you're beholding, that's what's changed. There's an aesthetic experience that has made one more engaging, one more appealing than the other. Similarly, like, let's say you're going to be sitting on the couch. You're sitting on the couch for 10 minutes, and pretending that you're not, like, you haven't just run around or whatever, so you're just relaxing, but you're sitting on the couch for like 10 minutes by yourself. You're probably going to get bored somewhat quickish, but if you're sitting on the couch for 10 minutes with your arm around the person that you are at this point in time married to or seeing, like, that 10 minutes is like, wait, what just happened? It's 3 hours. Like, it's a much more enjoyable time. It's a time that you're more engaged in, and that's an aesthetic experience. Because what happens is you're enjoying this time more because there's some area of beauty. There's some thing that is happening that is different than in the other more boring situation. In the other area, you're more engaged and more drawn to something. And that's where beauty's coming into. I'm pausing briefly here because I have a pin in my pocket that I accidentally just unscrewed the top of, and I don't want to get ink all over my pants. Fantastic. So the thing is this, experiences matter. So as by the way, I don't try to like pull things off and be like all coy. I'm like, this is exactly what I did wrong. Let me just be completely. My youth enjoy that. I youth pastor as well. Anyways, so the thing is, experiences matter, and experiences aren't just feelings. People are able to chalk up experiences to just being in the realm of feelings. There's an emotional aspect to experiences, but your experiences are more than just your feelings about something. Experiences are actual things that happen in the aesthetic sphere. It's not just the feeling that those cause in you. Like, and it's important when we're talking about this, because like, if we're talking about like experiences of the religious nature, when you have a religious experience, it's not just feelings that are happening. Feelings are a part of that experience, but there's something more, something's causing those feelings, something's starting those feelings, and that's where aesthetics is coming in. Aesthetics is looking at things that appeals to the imagination, that appeals to and draws out those feelings. So, I want to start... that wasn't a start. There's a guy named Crispin Sartwell, who I'm sure everyone here has read many books by. I've only read one. He is an atheist, but he wrote a book called The Six Names of Beauty, and he tells about the story when he was at a Venetian cathedral, and he walked into it. The cathedral was all big and massive and gorgeous. And he said that at that moment, being in that cathedral, looking at that cathedral, looking around at the beauty of what had been around him, he's an atheist, but he says at that point in time, he came to a point where he actually desired that there was a God who existed. Not that he believed, and he's still an atheist, but being in that cathedral at that moment, being surrounded by what he was surrounded by, that cathedral was designed in such a way as to make him desire that there was a God. Not that he believed it, but that he wanted there to be one. And the reason is because he stumbled around this connection with the fact that beauty and God are connected. They most certainly are, and the church has, the Christian tradition has seen this for a long time, but we've forgotten it. We've cut it out a lot. If you look at the Middle Ages, that's why the cathedrals look the way that they do. The people who built the cathedrals were under the impression that in the building of the cathedral, they were worshiping God. And they wanted the church to resemble the God and teach and be able to preach the message of the God who exists to people who are illiterate and weren't able to read. And so they built scripture out of stone and glass in their mind. That's what they were trying to do. Was medieval theology correct? I'm a Protestant, so no. But the fact is, what they were doing there makes sense. What they were doing there was attempting to maintain and keep that beauty in check and appeal to our humanness in a way, appeal to that image of God within us, to perceive that which is beautiful, to draw people to God. And that's what Sartwell experienced. We don't really have that too much today. I don't want to necessarily go on a tirade about church architecture. All I know is, as youth pastor at my church, I have no problem playing a game of dodgeball in our sanctuary. It's not really dodgeball because the pews are still there, but like it was a really fun game. Like, I divided the youth into teams and I gave them all like ball pit balls, and then I took Thor's hammer because I'm a geek, and so why wouldn't I own a Thor's hammer? And I set that behind the baptistry, and I was like, all right, one of your jobs is to go get the Thor's hammer. The other's job is to protect it. Go. And so they were throwing the balls at each other. It was great. Sunday, there were a few balls up on top of the speaker that fell off in the middle of the worship set, which I was like, I don't know what. That, what happened? But the thing is, like, I had no problem doing it. I was like, yeah, it's just a building. Okay, sure. And the fact is, it's just a building. But, like, if I were to go into that Venetian cathedral, I'd have a hard time being like, dodgeball, dodgeball, dodgeball. Like, you know, something feels wrong about that. It's because of how it's structured, because of how it's built, because of what it's built to relate and communicate. That structure is built to communicate through beauty something deeper than what my church's building is trying to communicate. And so that's where what I want to look at is the fact that beauty has a content. And there's a reason that I personally think that beauty and God are connected. Scripture is full of it, full of that. Psalm 27:4, one thing that I have asked of the Lord that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life and gaze upon the beauty of the Lord to inquire in his temple. Psalm 90:17, let the beauty of the Lord be Lord our God be upon us and establish the work of our hands upon us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. And there are tons of other references to beauty in there. There's a tradition of the fact that God is beautiful. And what I want to look at here is what do we mean when we say that God is beautiful? What are we communicating? Because words have a content, and I think beauty has a content, and it's communicating the truth and is affirming the truth. But I think that we don't understand what beauty is as a society. And I say that primarily from the States, but I'm pretty sure Canada is on board with this, that as a society we don't understand what beauty is. The West has lost an understanding of beauty. It goes back to a guy by the name of Immanuel Kant, which is surprising because usually everything bad, I think, goes back to David Hume. But this time it was Immanuel Kant. But we'll get there. One of the theologians, though, I'm going to quote a lot here, is a guy with probably my favorite name in church theology. He's a Catholic theologian who died in the 1980s. His name is Hans Urs von Balthasar. With a name like that, you are either a theologian or a professor at Hogwarts, and one of those is fake. Sadly, it's not the theologian. He's a theologian, and so I'm going to quote him a lot because he has done tons in the area of aesthetics. He wrote a 14-volume set, the seven volumes that were just called his Theological Aesthetics. And one of the things he says is this: truth without beauty loses its cogency. And goodness without beauty loses its attractiveness. Truth without beauty loses its cogency. Goodness without beauty loses attractiveness. The good, the true, and the beautiful, classic Greek philosophy, are all interwoven. They're interconnected. That which is true, and because it is true, it is beautiful and is good. If you take away the beauty from that which is true, it no longer makes sense. If you take away the goodness from that which is true, it no longer makes sense. If you take away the goodness from the beautiful, it's not beautiful anymore. If you take away truth from beauty, it's just empty. It's glamour. It's not anything real. It's what we call pretty today. That's what we call beauty today. It's nothing. If you take away truth or beauty from goodness, goodness becomes just mandated law. Like, there's nothing attractive. There's a difference between mandated draconian law and goodness, absolute morality, which is attractive and draws in. So the idea of truth without beauty loses its cogency. Goodness without beauty loses its attractiveness. Without beauty, which is the thing that we've lost the most, and it comes from the modernist idea that beauty is nothing and beauty is completely subjective. When you take away that element of beauty, truth and goodness lose a lot. And I think Balthazar's statement there explains what we see in our churches. The fact is, and I don't know what the statistics are up here, but down in the States, 85 to 87% of kids who go to youth group when they hit university bail on the Christian faith. I think in large part of that is because youth pastors do an awful job teaching theology, which is what John Patrick was talking about. But I think a large part is the fact that youth pastors in the church and Christian families have done an awful job explaining the beauty of Christianity, that we've done a horrible job displaying the beauty of Christ. We explain a bunch of rules. We explain a bunch of mandates about what you're supposed to do. We harp heavily on moral edicts, but we haven't displayed the beauty. We haven't displayed Christ for who Christ is. We haven't displayed the Christ that appears to Paul, or Saul rather, on the road to Damascus. We haven't depicted what's called in medieval theology the beatific vision, which is just the idea, the vision of God that draws you in to it. We don't do that. We don't look at God. We look at God as our buddy. We look about him as like our friend and our chum that we'll hang out with and stuff. But the highly exalted, glorious God, that doesn't come out much. The God that we should be drawn into doesn't happen a lot. I think that's because we lack this beauty concept, which means we should probably talk about what beauty is. You know, because I've been throwing around the word like crazy. So I probably should unpack it a little bit. Going back to Sartwell, the guy, the atheist who went to the cathedral, he says that beauty is, or we find beautiful, that which we desire. So for Sartwell, what beauty means is that if I call something beautiful, what that means is that I desire that thing. Like that's what the term beauty means. I desire that thing. So when we say that God is beautiful, for Sartwell, what I'm saying is I desire God, or I don't want God, which he's not completely wrong, but he's not right, because there's a lot more to beauty than that. If I'm making the claim, and we'll talk about this more a little bit later, but when I'm making the claim that something's beautiful, I think that I'm saying more than I just want this thing. I hope I am, otherwise it's a horrible compliment. Just think about that. You know, anyone in here who's ever been called beautiful, and that could be guy or girl. You know, but in our society, it's probably, you know, I mean, guys used to be called beautiful. We don't do that anymore because now we think that's weird. You know, but I mean, honestly, if you sit there and be like, "Oh, you're beautiful," if you're not making a claim about me and you're just saying, "I desire you," it's nowhere near the compliment that it was. You're not saying anything about me. You're telling me about you, and maybe you're broken. You know, it's like, and so that's what I'm hearing. And so there's probably more than that. So Balthazar, he comes back and says that we love something because it's beautiful. It's not that I see something as beautiful because I want it. It's that I want something because it's beautiful. And when I want it because it's beautiful and I see that thing's beauty, that will make me want it more. So for Balthazar, beauty works in a circular fashion. I perceive the beauty of something, and when I perceive the beauty of something, it increases in desire within me that allows me to see its beauty more, and then it becomes a cyclical thing because that'll make me desire it more. Now, that's just trying to begin to lay down some ideas about what beauty is. If we want to use a nice academic definition, we could say that beauty is that quality which a thing has that demands adoration. I think that's a good way to understand beauty. Again, when you call someone beautiful, you probably don't play it out that way, but honestly, guys, try that. It is smooth. You know, but the fact is, apparently a girl in the back laughs, so don't try it on her, because that's not going to work at all. She's like, heard it. Stay with your philosophy flirting. But the fact that what is beautiful? Beauty is that thing, that quality that an object has that demands adoration, which means I'm not bringing anything to it. But when I see something that is beautiful, this thing has a quality that demands that I adore it. It is calling out to me, I have no... So when Sartwell was in that cathedral was beautiful. And by that cathedral was beautiful, what he means is that that cathedral demanded adoration from him. It was such that being in its presence, you could not help but adore it. That's what beauty is. Beauty is that quality that something has. So when we say that something is beautiful, what we mean is that it has this quality. There is, and philosophers, we say that quality when what we mean is, you know, it. Like, we can't really define it, but it's that quality that something has that demands that we adore it. That's what we're going to say that beauty is. For Balthazar, and I think it's right for the Christian tradition, that, what we're talking about there, is God's self-revelation. That's God's glory. Why do we adore God? It's because of God's beauty. It's that about God which demands adoration. That about who God is, it demands adoration. It's God's self-revelation to us through natural theology, through who he is, that demands adoration. That's why I think one of the things I find interesting is that when you look at population distributions, the most atheistic sectors of society are the ones that are most industrialized. And the least atheistic sectors of society are the ones that are most rural. And I think part of that makes sense. I live in Orange County, California, which means when I look up at my night sky, I see half of Orion's belt, and maybe a few other stars here. I have somewhat of a dipper, but I definitely don't have Ursa Major. I have like part of a ladle. But when I go up to somewhere, you know, the mountains or someplace that's not smog-laden, and I look up at the night sky and I see the bajillion stars that are up there, if I'm trying to think as an atheist, I have a much harder time trying to think as an atheist when I see that night sky than when I see the night sky where I live. 2 years ago, I took a class called Atheism and Secularity. which was about atheism and secularity, by the way. And the professor was a hardcore atheist, and spoiler alert, I wasn't. And so he and I would disagree a lot and yell, and it was fantastic, and I loved it. But for the purpose of that class, I tried to think atheistically. I tried to put myself in that mind and see how I can get there. And what I discovered is that when there's this, off of Pacific Coast Highway down in Southern California, there's this nice little place where you have benches that can look out at the ocean, and there's almost no beach, which is great, because I hate the beach, but I love the ocean. And so there's a great place where I could sit there and look out at the ocean. I could also sit there and think about the whole cubicle thing, which we've already covered. And I realized it was easier for me to think as an atheist when I was inside a building with no access to nature whatsoever. But when I was outside looking at God's creation, it was much harder for me to become to think atheistically, because there's something about that nature, something about that revealed that idea where God is revealing something about himself through beauty to me. And as a believer, I can pick that up. I'm not Romans 1 in it, but we'll get to Romans 1 in a bit. So when we talk about absolute beauty, what that means for Balthazar, we have God's self-revelation, God's or His glory. God's self-revelation, God's glory. I would say, Balthazar would say it, and I would agree with it, are the same, one the same. We talk about absolute beauty. What we mean is divine love. God's beauty and God's love are strongly interconnected. That's why we love things that are beautiful. When we are attracted to something, we love that thing. We love children. They are cute. We see that. You know, puppies. Puppies are adorable. I hate cats, and I love kittens. You know, because I'm like, oh, you're precious. You're going to be horrible in a year, but right now you're so precious. You know, and that's why, I mean, you have to, because apparently I'm not a parent, but like I have friends. My best friend has 3 kids, and what I picked up is that their 2-year-old is an obnoxious little brat, but he's adorable. You know, like he is. Like I look at him, I'm like, oh, Elijah, you should take care of what he's doing right now, but he's so cute. And why? It's like, well, because we are drawn to this adorableness. You know, there, in light of, which is great, in spite of how they act. But there's this, we love that which we are attracted to. Well, I'm so far behind where I want to be right now. So, societally wise, though, we use the word beauty differently than I'm using beauty. And I think that's important to understand, this distinction here. If nothing else, this, I think, be worth what we're looking at. The way we use beauty today is cheap. We use beauty in a very cheap way today, and it's a much different thing. And this is what happened. So Immanuel Kant, Prussian philosopher of the Enlightenment, he is the first guy to make this distinction. He made a distinction between 2 subdivisions in aesthetic philosophy. He said you have the beautiful and you have the sublime. The beautiful is that which you look at and you find pleasing because there's order to it. So if there's order, there's symmetry, that's great. The sublime is that which is terrifying. For him, the sublime is the thing that your mind can't make sense out of, because he had this weird philosophy about a bunch of categories in your brain. No need to bore you with it right now. But he said the sublime is when you look at something, your brain can't make sense out of it. It's huge, it's ominous, it's terrifying, but you can't look away, it draws you in. For myself, one way to look at this is in Southern California, well, in Northern California, there's a mountain called Mount Shasta, which I'm pretty sure is like not a mountain in Canada. I think it's like a hill. But it's still like there's just, you know, this massive thing that draws you in. The Aurora Borealis, Mount Everest. There's these massive things that you look at them and you can't fully comprehend them, but there's a sense of awe and there's a sense of dread. But it's not a bad dread. Like, there's some dreads that are bad. Like, when I'm going to get a shot, yeah, I dread the heck out of that. And that's not beautiful. I just faint. But there are other things that you have a sense of dread about, but it's an anticipatory dread. It's an excited dread. I've talked to, you know, like, my friend Rachel, and she was talking about, like, the night before her wedding. Like, she was excited but freaked out at the same time. She's like, it's hard to define what I'm feeling right now. And that's what the sublime is talking about. For the ancients, for the medievals, for the biblical authors, the beautiful and the sublime are the same thing. There's no distinction between them. When you use the term beautiful, you're talking about something that draws you in, but almost has a crushing type power to it in some sense. It's something that pulls you in, but it also can crush you, but like not in a way that's bad, but in a way that's still mildly terrifying. Which, by the way, makes beautiful a much bigger compliment than the way we use it. Because what we say when we say beautiful, we mean, hey, nice eyes. That's a cheap understanding of beauty. That's where John O'Donnell says that we mistake beauty for glamour. Like, we look at glamour and we call that beauty. That's not beauty. Beauty is something deeper than that. But when we've taken the sublime out of it, that's bad. And the thing is, when you take out the sublime, beauty just can't stand up. Beauty collapses in and on itself. Beauty needs to have the sublime there. It needs to have a metaphysics or a spiritual world to hold it up. Otherwise, beauty is purely subjective. And I hold that beauty is objective, which is completely countercultural. But beauty is an objective thing. It's not a subjective taste, I don't think. So is it possible? So the thing to ask is this. When it comes to objective beauty, is something beautiful merely because I find it pleasing? Is that what we determine beautiful? I'm going to say no. But just think about this. If so, if we take that to be the case, what Sartre will say to be the case, then again, when I call a girl beautiful, what I'm saying to her is that you cause within me beautiful feelings. If you've read C.S. Lewis's The Abolition of Man, if you haven't, you should. But he's talking about a waterfall. And he says that in that, there's a book he read called The Green Book where people talked about the waterfall being sublime. And he said, well, the waterfall is not sublime. The waterfall just makes me feel sublime. And there's a distinction there. Is the waterfall sublime in and of itself, or does the waterfall make me feel sublime? Because if it makes me feel sublime, that means that I'm not saying anything about the waterfall. I'm just telling you about myself. And when I make these types of statements, I'm just communicating to you things about me. So when I say God is beautiful, I'm not saying that God is beautiful. I'm saying that God makes me feel beautifully, which I'm not saying. I'm saying that God is beautiful. I'm saying this in an objective sense. And so I think that's important here. So it's not that beauty is in the eye of the beholder only. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but only if that means that the eye of the beholder is changed in order to recognize beauty. Now, I realize I'm throwing beauty around like crazy, and I'm going quick because I was given 45 minutes, and I want to try to have something for question and answer, and I'm probably not going to. That's a pipe dream. So I'm throwing a bunch of aesthetics philosophy out there, so I'm sorry if it seems slightly disjointed. But up to now, what I'm trying to look at as a fact is this. I think beauty is objective. Objective beauty is grounded in God. That which we found, we're attracted to beauty because we are made in God's image, and we desire that beauty. We love what we find beautiful, and we find love itself beautiful. But that doesn't necessarily mean that everything that we would consider beautiful is actually beautiful. And that's where I think we get to this. It's an important part, because this is where people will say that beauty is not objective, because people disagree about what's beautiful. Like, there's a huge disagreement there. And so this is what is important. Just because someone doesn't find something beautiful doesn't mean that it's not beautiful. Like, that doesn't work. I mean, consider a blind person. Like, a blind person, I mean, they're not going to consider grass green because it's a sphere they can't talk about. So not everyone's going to necessarily agree on that. There's something called visual agnosia. Visual agnosia is where, like, you can look at an apple, but you don't see an apple. You just see a red sphere and a brown stem, but you don't put the pieces together. Alistair McGrath has a book called The Open Secret where he's talking about nature that way. And he says that the lost have visual agnosia. They can't interpret natural revelation the way that we should be able to if we weren't fallen. And so not everyone, just because there's disagreement about taste doesn't mean that something that's beautiful stops being beautiful. I mean, just think about this. Let's say that you have like a dead leg, or for some reason you've lost feeling in your right leg, and you throw it in a jacuzzi, and you're like, I don't think it's hot. Well, yeah, no, you can't feel anything in your leg. That doesn't mean that it's not hot. It just means that there's something wrong with you. And again, that gets very offensive. But the statement is this. If beauty is objective and someone doesn't perceive beauty properly, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong with beauty. That means there's something wrong with the one receiving it. There's an error on that. Now, taste is an issue. Because taste, we all have individual tastes. And taste skews the way that we receive beauty. So, I mentioned beforehand that I hate sour cream. Without a doubt, I can't stand it. Some of you in here may like sour cream. I'm going to pray for you afterwards. Or ranch dressing. That stuff's disgusting. Pretty much if it's a white sauce that doesn't make you want milk, I'm not on board. But that means that if someone were to ask me, hey, Sam, is this good sour cream? I would not be able to tell them if this sour cream was good. I would not be able to tell them if the sour cream was beautiful because it's sour cream. My taste is against sour cream, and therefore, no matter how good the sour cream is, actually the best sour cream probably would taste the worst to me. I don't understand that. I don't like pineapple. And my friend's like, Sam, you haven't had this pineapple. This is best pineapple. I was like, then logically, that is worst pineapple, because if it tastes the best of the things I don't like, it tastes the worst. Like, that's how it goes. But I would not be the one to talk about sour cream then, because I could not pick up the beauty. But if someone's taste is inclined towards sour cream, they could probably pick up the beauty of a beautiful sour cream. They could tell you, like salsa, I love salsa. I could tell you what a good salsa is, because my taste is so inclined to salsa. I'm in Canada talking about Mexican food. That's weird. I should be talking about maple syrup and bacon that's actually ham. should be doing that. Anyways, the fact is, so taste. So there's a lot of things when it comes to why people don't pick up the beauty of God, why people do not find God attractive. It's a taste issue. David Bentley Hart says that the reason Nietzsche was an atheist is because he had bad taste. There wasn't any other reason. There was no argument. There was nothing else aside from the fact that he just had bad taste. And so he wasn't able to properly taste and see that the Lord is good. He wasn't able to properly understand that. He wasn't able to properly be drawn. But the fact is, taste can be overcome. And so, and that's what I look at when it comes to this taste issue. First off, I have a lot of friends who don't like classical music. I don't get them, because I love classical music. Like, I don't listen to it all the time. That's country. But still, like, I like classical music. But I don't have any friends who don't like Mozart. There's something about Mozart's music that even if what you listen to all the time is gangster rap, like, listening to Mozart, there's some quality to what he did that draws a person in and makes someone at least say, I can see why that's appealing. Not necessarily, I mean, Beethoven doesn't have the same appeal for some reason, but there's something about what Mozart did that people will look at that and say, even though that's not my genre of music, he's not talking about capping fools. There's something about him, there's something about what's being done there that is appealing. There's something about that can draw a person in. So at one point in time, how did taste change? How can we overcome taste? It could just be that beauty itself presents itself and overwhelms someone and takes a person in because of its sheer beauty and magnitude. Paintings do that all the time. Someone who's not necessarily an art fan has a painting presented to them, and that can just draw a person in. That's what happened to Sartwell when he was in that cathedral. On the other hand, there's an idea of this. Continuing with music, one of the, I don't want to say easiest ways, but like let's say that you there's a certain type of music that you don't like. I mentioned country music. I like country music. I have a lot of friends who don't like country music. If we're talking and I say, no, listen to this song again. I really like this song. Give the song a try. There is a chance that because of the relationship that my friend Brad and I have, that he will listen to the song again, but listen to the song again differently than he listened to it before because of the friendship that he and I have, the respect that he has for me, the compassion, the care that we have for each other, and listen to the song differently, and in that transfer the feelings he has towards me toward that song. And therefore, the taste alters. That happens a lot. That's, all of you can probably give times at which there's a thing that you didn't like, that you've had that change happen because of the emotion, the connection, or relationship you have with somebody else. When we're talking about the idea of beauty of God, when we're interacting with someone about the situation of God, we have to realize we affect people's taste. And it's very easy for the church to affect people's taste in such a way that we do not positively change their taste towards God, but we negatively influence it. Down the States, I'm sure you guys have heard of them, we have this obnoxious group called Westboro Baptist, and they literally go out of their way to make the culture hate us, which they don't need help. They don't need help. To make it, but they in no way are they doing anything to help affect the world and change and alter that taste and transfer ideology in any situation and way. Another way that taste can change is just by maturation. I love spicy food, and I mean that like in both ways. Like Indian food is fantastic because it's got like tons of spice in it, but also burns your face off. Like big fan both. But like I'm pretty sure as a 5-year-old I would not have loved vindaloo as much as I do now because I just wasn't old enough for it. Like a 5-year-old's palate, mac and cheese is the food. Like if you're like, would you like filet mignon or mac and cheese? Mac and cheese. You know, like that's what they want. Also a cold hot dog, please. It's like because it comes with the age. There's a taste situation that they haven't grown or matured to hold a certain taste. So as time progresses, as people mature, taste can change that way. So when we're looking at the idea of not perceiving something as beautiful, that's a taste issue. But tastes can alter, and tastes can alter in a lot of different ways. Maturation, being overcome, or it could just be by the relationship and the connection that we have, that people have with others. Let's see. The lost don't see God's beauty because their taste is broken. That's what I'm going to say. Obviously, if anyone here is actually here just as a skeptic, sorry if that's offensive, but this is my belief. In my atheist class, I had someone, lost one, and so when I was in my atheist class, the atheist professor looked at me one time and asked, "Why do you think I don't believe?" And I said, "Well, Romans 1 tells me that you're suppressing the truth. You know the truth. You know that there's a God. You know Christianity is accurate. You just are pushing it down." He didn't take that well. Looking back, I probably should approach that differently. But the fact is, it's true. That's what it says. And so I should have said, it's because your tastes are not attuned to God. You know, it's because his tastes are attuned against God. And so that which is actually beautiful, he sees as repulsive. With my youth group, I use the example, like if you're hungry and I lay out like two plates in front of you, and one plate, they're youth groups, kids. So like one plate is like a plate of pizza. And how this is being recorded, I don't want to use what I normally do. So one plate is a plate of pizza, and the other, well, let's just go ahead and say it's a bunch of vomit. So I have the option, like, okay, so you're hungry, which would you like to eat? Would you like the vomit or would you like the pizza? Like, yeah, you could, I guess you could choose the vomit, but you're not going to. You're going to choose the pizza every time because that is more attractive, that is more appealing. What happens is the reason people reject God is because they do not see the appealingness. They miss that. They improperly perceive and improperly see what is attractive and what is not. There's a taste issue that has it, so they don't approach things properly. Just like in the same way that we talk about a joke being in bad taste, there are a lot of people that will laugh at jokes that are in bad taste. Why? Because their taste is broken and they don't understand that this is not okay. And so when someone says that they reject God, when someone says they don't see Christ's beauty, that tells us more about their sinful condition than it tells us about God. Like, it's important to understand when someone rejects that, someone says, "I just don't see anything appealing about Christianity," that tells us more, I believe, about them than it does about Christianity. That doesn't mean that Christianity is invalid. It doesn't mean that Christianity is false. Because I believe that God is a fount of beauty, and God is constantly shining forth beauty into the world as a means of communicating his content to us to draw people to himself. Because he's a fount of beauty. And there are three responses that Balthazar lays out, and I think he's right, about the responses to God's beauty. One, there's blindness. Blindness is just missing the beauty. It's Romans 1, and the person just completely misses the idea of beauty. They don't understand. They don't have any concept. They miss what is being communicated, like we've talked about. Number two is that they attempt to destroy it. It's not that they miss the beauty. It's that they see it, and they see that there could be something beautiful there, but they hate it. And because of that, instead what they want to do is they want to be the person, they want to destroy and attack and bring down beauty. This would be the new atheist. And when I say that, I don't mean someone who's an atheist. I mean Dawkins and Loftus and Hitchens and the guys who are just super angry for no real good reason. These are those people. Like that type of person, they want to just destroy beauty. But what we're looking for, and obviously the way that conversion happens in Christianity, is that people are overtaken by it. When a person is overtaken by beauty and submits to the beauty of God, that's when conversion happens. Because when it was overtaken by beauty, it causes love within the person for that which is beautiful. In turn, making that which is love be seen as more beautiful, etc. When God is seen as a beautiful God that he is, that draws within a person inherently to love them, to love him. There's no option in that situation, really. I don't say that to try to get to a free will discussion. I mean, you can have free will discussions like crazy all you want after this. But what I'm saying is that when you behold that beauty, when you behold that which about God which causes adoration, which demands adoration, that moves and stirs love within us. Now, maybe you could say that a person then goes into point two and just wants to destroy it because he hates it and he goes all Smeagol and stuff. That's fine. But the point is, there's still something that is drawing and crushing in that situation that comes to beauty. So based upon that, this is what I suggest our role is. This is what I suggest our role as people who are apologists, as people who are thoughtful Christians, as people who are trying to stand up for the Christian faith in this world and bring people into the kingdom and in relation with this loving, beautiful God who exists. I think we need to start seeing ourselves as tour guides. I've gotten to a point where I almost want to stop using the word apologist to describe myself, which is bad because I'm with a group called apologetics.com, so cat's out of the bag on that one. But back in June, I had a discussion with a Jewish apologist. She called me because she called my church, and my church was like, oh, no, Sam wants to talk to you. Because at my church, when someone wants to talk for a long time, they're like, yeah, just pawn them off on Sam. And so I was going to go vote, and I was walking, and she called and goes, hey, are you Sam? I was like, yeah. She goes, okay, this is what I think. And I'm like, and you are? Okay. And so the conversation I had with her, though, she was hostile, she was angry, and she just started going through like these rehearsed arguments over and over and over again. And I started thinking as she was talking, man, I hope that's not what people think I am when I say I'm an apologist. Because apologetics has been seen too often as a war game. It's been seen too often as trying to take these arguments and take these tools and play whack-a-mole with them and just sit there and like pick up the mighty Thor hammer that is the cosmological argument and just smack the head of the atheist as they pop up. Like, and don't be wrong, that's funsies. I've been on YouTube. But I don't know that that's the best use. I think what I consider a tour guide approach makes more sense. And like, so consider, like, you're at a museum. And you go to a painting, and, like, you see the painting, and there's, like, 10 of you in the tour. When you see the painting, like, 5 people immediately see the beauty of the painting. And the other 5 don't. And then the tour guide starts talking. And the tour guide starts pointing out, you know, the different brushstrokes that were used, the different colors that were used, and how the different colors offset each other, and what was being painted, what was going on at the time as this was being done. And all of a sudden, as these things are being explained, as the tour guide starts pointing out these different facets of the painting, the tour guide just can't point to one thing and be like, boom, that's a beautiful. Like, that's not the way it works. But as the tour guide starts pointing this out, 3 of the remaining 5 start understanding the beauty of the painting. All of a sudden, the beauty is making sense. The other 2 still, they're like, I got nothing. Can we go play video games? Like, I don't want to be here. But 3 of the other 5, like, they start understanding the beauty. I think that's our job as apologists or people trying to defend. I don't think our job is necessarily to answer every question. I don't think our job is to try and hunt down people and just unload them. When I was a high schooler, I had more missionaries come to my house, and it was fun. It was a blast. Like, camped out with them for like 18 hours. Not at one stretch. That'd be ludicrous. But when I was referring to people about it, what you're doing was like, oh man, last night I had such a fun time slaughtering Mormons. That was not the right way to approach it. That was not the right way to say it. But that's a lot of times the way we approach apologetics. And that's not the right way to do it. We need to look at it like we're being the tour guides. And let's use the arguments. Let's use the cosmological argument. Let's use the ontological argument, because I love that one. You know, let's use all the arguments. But not in a way that we're trying to sit there and just decimate this person. But we're just pointing stuff out about the universe, about the cosmos, and be like, no, teleologically, look at this. Look at the way things are created. It just seems that God's the best explanation for that. It just seems, don't be angry, don't be hostile. You know, they'll be angry or hostile to you. That's cool. Reflect Christ. One of the things, and I'll end with more Balthazar here. Balthazar wrote a book called Love Alone is Credible. It's a 150-page sermon based on the 3,000-page Aesthetics that he wrote. But his basic argument there is that the world in the Enlightenment stopped being drawn to God through the church when the church started fighting itself. When the wars of religion started in Europe, and the Presbyterians were killing the Lutherans, and the Lutherans were killing the Baptists, and the Catholics were killing everyone, and they were all killing the Catholics. Like, when all that happened, all that fighting, and all the people that were saying, God is love, started just destroying each other, that's when people stopped being drawn to us. And he's not saying that to mean that we just need to be complete pacifists. He's not saying that to mean that we don't stand up for our rights. He's not saying for any of that. But what he's saying is that when we stopped taking seriously what love is, people stopped being drawn to the beauty of God through the church because we stopped reflecting it. So what I'm going to say is that based upon beauty, when it comes to, and I know the title of this was an argument for God from beauty. I don't think there's an argument for God from beauty. That'd be an intelligent design discussion. And that's science-y. I don't do that. Numbers and stuff. And it's like pretty things. But I think there's something to be said for the fact that we are drawn to that which is beautiful. We love that which is attractive. God is the fount of all beauty. And if we love God, we should image him, because when people see us, they are supposed to honor God, desire to worship God because of who we are. there's a transference that can happen in the way that we interact with people. And there are more people in the church today that are honest followers of Christ because of the relationship that they had with believers than because of the people who got smacked with a bunch of arguments. I'm not saying that arguments aren't important. I'm not saying that arguments aren't used in the kingdom. There are people, Greg Kokel is saved because of argumentation. But as he's saved because of argumentation brought to him by someone who cared enough about him to share that in a way that the person is open to it. Just realize, like, the relationship you have with someone affects the way someone receives what you have to say. There are certain people who can say things to me that I will accept anything that they say, no matter how critical it is. There are other people that I'll be like, why don't you just go ahead and shut your mouth and never talk again? And you have to earn the right to say hard things. You have to earn the right to do that. You have to display Christ's beauty in that. So, just in closing here, because I have 30 seconds before I say that we're done. What I think about when it comes to the relation of God and beauty, I think beauty originates from God, and that God uses beauty to draw people to Him. I think beauty is a gift from God, and is an inherent part of something that we see or draw to because we are made in His image. We are made in His image, and we are made to worship a God who is beautiful, which is why we desire beauty. We cheapen that often and buy into glamour and false beauty in the same way that we cheapen truth and buy in for lies, or and cheapen goodness and buy in and obedience. That happens. It's easy for us to cheapen anything that we're drawn to and just accept something that's less than that. I think the Christian faith brings out and explains beauty the best. And I think we need to actually live lives of beauty that the outside world can look at and be drawn to and come in contact with God because of. I don't have time for open forum Q&A, but if you have things you want to ask or castigate me on afterwards, feel free. We got 15-minute passing period. Otherwise, there's other better sessions that you can go to open in the next round because we, I believe, officially are finished. So thank you for coming.